This is the second tape with my interview on the 12th of March 2005 with Commander Chance.
From going back to kinds of equipment, from the Corvette we then developed the frigate, and both the frigate and the Corvette had greater endurance, really, I think, looking back on it, than the destroyers that we served in, from a fuel standpoint. And whereas the Corvettes had short ones, and they had what they call extended focals, which are a little bit more livable. But those little vessels were workhorses, but they were the most uncomfortable goddamn ships. And we used to say, as we looked at them, "Good God, I can see the mast, the top of the mast, and then I can see the whole darn vessel." And they similarly were looking across at us. They could see us, and then they could see us out of the water right up to the first funnel. And when we get ashore in Londonderry, we get together and say, "Good God, how the hell did you make it?" Said, "Hell, we'd rather be in the frigate, in the Corvette, than we are the new guys over in that damn destroyer." And so it both had its things. But it was survival due to the weather and the ships rolling around and so on. Then there came what they call castle-class Corvettes. They were built in England. We only had 12 of them. But they were great ships. And they had squid. And it made a big difference. But the overall quantity and quality of the ships improved. The destroyers, which were originally so-called fleet destroyers, became escort vessels, with the second funnel cut down, and they removed one or two guns and increased the anti-submarine equipment and so on. It wasn't really until after the war that we started really thinking about new equipment and better equipment. One of the biggest single problems to do with anti-submarine detection of devices was that what we call layers, thermal layers, and some areas of the sea weren't bad. You could get down quite well. Others were impossible, and so that a sonar transmission would go down so far and then bounce, and so you simply didn't. A submarine below that layer could get away with impunity. Mm-hmm. So that was a big problem. We developed sonar, not sonar buoys, but we developed eventually. What they call them? They were. It was a device whereby you could send a cylinder over the side to a certain depth and draw it up, and then it could be analyzed, and you'd get a better idea of the water content and/or its salinity, and hence the business of thermal layers becoming more known. But this was all pretty much in its infancy, you know. We had Starshell, by the way. I forgot to mention Starshell. We used a lot of that. And Starshell was used to illuminate the entire convoy when an attack was on, in order to, hopefully, to allow the escorts to see the submarines, because in the early days, the Germans fought the battle on the surface, and they were brave and they're daring, and they created enormous havoc. And it wasn't until much later that we managed to win that one. Fairly large part by Bletchley Park breaking the German codes and being able to advise Admiralty, and hence Admiralty advising everyone else, to redirect convoys away from the concentration of the submarines. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you probably recall, the head of the German submarine organization required that boats on station report their position at noon every day, which is a dead giveaway, of course, because we were listening. And but radar never really twigged to this for some reason. We never did find that out, to my knowledge, anyhow. Which helped, again, which helped us and Admiralty in particular.
So let's that's great. Let's move on and talk about your experiences personally fighting these U-boats in the Atlantic.
Well, first of all, we had no experience in convoys in 1943 in Skeena. In 1944, I was in a ship still in Skeena, but in a group called EG-12, and we operated out of Plymouth for the D-Day operation as one of the two groups, particularly destroyer groups, on the western flank to the English Channel. And the idea was to attempt to stop submarines infiltrating to the battle line, and which was mostly coming out of Portsmouth and to the east across to Normandy. Well, we had quite a lot of contacts. As I mentioned earlier, the English Channel is fairly shallow, and it was pretty hazardous for anybody in the submarine business to be in that part of the world. But they had another thing going for them, though, which was that the bottom was littered with wrecks for years and years, generations, hundreds of years worth of wrecks down there, and for which we were then supplied specifically by through the fishermen's organization with wreck charts, because the fishermen had to have such things so they wouldn't get their nets ensnarled in these wrecks. Well, they also provided a kind of subterfuge for the submarines, because they lie alongside one of them. And more often than not, we would think, Jesus, that's a submarine, fine! And we'd fire away like crazy at it with depth charges and one thing and another. And of course, it was a non-sub. It was a wreck. On the other hand, the Germans had invented a wonderful device called an acoustic torpedo. We call it a gnat, because it had the ability to home in on the noises created by your propeller as it turned. Well, there was another wonderful guy to whom I owe my life. His name was Commander Daddy Pierce. We call him P-E-R-S. He came from out here. And he invented a thing known as CAT gear, Canadian anti-torpedo gear, which comprised, perhaps you know of it, was just
I've heard of it, yeah.
Two pipes about the size of your middle finger and about 18 inches long, held together by two rubber clamps, these two pipes. And both of them, again, made fast to a yoke of wire, which then led to a single wire, which went right back to the ship, but which the whole issue was trailed behind your ship at a good safe distance, maybe 800 feet, or maybe more even. Well, when the ship moved through the water, so the water passed through these pipes, and it made the pipes touch one another, which we call chattering. And the chattering noise was greater than that of your propeller. And so that the gnat torpedo, instead of blowing you up, blew itself up in the cat gear. Simple. And of course, the Americans and the Brits adopted this cat gear. They called it Foxer. And it worked. Well, we had six of those little babies thrown at us one morning. Again, sort of hazy, almost flat, calm, quite warm, and one of them was such that we saw the periscope went by, and we could see it, and we fire the hedgehogs. So it was lobbed off. At the same time, we could see it, and we turned towards the periscope, and as we did, there's a torpedo, and it came zinging down our side, about 10 feet off. You could see it.
Yeah.
And it went whizzing right past the stern, thank goodness, and it blew itself up in our wake. And Saskatchewan was another ship in our group, and she had another one that morning, and water completely enveloped her, and then it all fell away, and she was fine. So I said, oh, brother. So that was exciting. But then, later, and oh yes, we reckon we bruised that submarine. We never got credit for sinking it. He probably managed to get back into Brest or someplace. But in any case, later, we had two operations off the French coast. One of which was to do with submarines and surface vessels. And wherein, one night in August, I've forgotten the exact date, it was called Operation Dredger, and you can find it in the books. We were sent out with along with a starshell ship, Albrighton, I think her name was. Can't recall exactly. But we were sent from Plymouth, and we were sent down in south to go below Brest and almost to Penmarsh Point, which is the southern point of Odierne Bay. And then at a given time, we were to turn in to the coast, and at another time, we were to turn north again inside the range of the enemy shore batteries. It being assumed, we thought, that the Germans would think that we are friendly forces, we're French forces going up the coast. And that, again, at a certain point in time, I think it was one something or other in the morning, we were to be on a given course at a given time in a given place, and we would find the enemy. And we did. And at 4,000 yards, we opened up and we removed some trawlers. They were flak trawlers. They fired stuff at us. The lead ship captain was wounded, and he was out of action, and we took over. And all this was happening very quickly, as you can imagine. It didn't last all that long. And then from our plot, came, we have another target, sir, bearing so and so and so and so. Right, everybody, aim towards this new target. Target doesn't appear to be moving, sir. So the range is closing. And then suddenly, target's not moving, sir. I said, okay, so yeoman, expose the beam. So on goes the searchlight. Jesus, there in front of us is a lighthouse.
Uh-oh.
So hard over, and everybody got the hell out of there. We were bloody lucky, otherwise we could have climbed up on the shore on the lighthouse.
Yeah.
And all this was 19 knots. So that was exciting. Well, these flak ships were escorting submarines. The name of the game was to try to get them up through the channel to Kiel. And so that was that. Well then, we got back to Plymouth, and then shortly thereafter we were again out in the channel doing our patrol, I guess, and then barrier patrol. And then again later, there was another effort. By this time, the Germans are retreating from the Contentin Peninsula, Cherbourg area, and trying to get south. And we were sent in and to lay off the beaches and just fire everything we had at the beaches, at the barges that were being loaded with Germans and equipment for them to go down the coast, farther down the coast. And we had, it was quite an easy night. By that I mean it was almost calm, and hence the gunfire smoke was thick. Couldn't see a hell of a lot. And it was noisy, and the opposition was firing a lot of tracer at us, so we could see the stuff floating by. Anyway, the only thing that was exciting about it is at one point we thought, geez, we've been hit. And what happened was that the signalman had a strip Lewis on a spigot, and in his excitement, he took it off the spigot, and he fell back, and he drilled the inside of the bridge. So we had holes going out, not coming in the morning. But anyway, and then at one point, once again, the plot came up down below, said, we're standing into danger. Oh, we are? Well, yeah, yes, we are. We're standing in. Now, currents are pretty strong.
So what do you mean, standing into danger?
Well, you're hazarding your ship. You're going to plow into the land.
Right.
And so we passed this good word on to the lead ship, and they said, yes, we appreciate that. We're turning now. And so we thought, oh, yeah, they're turning now. So we're supposed to turn, are we? Well, yeah, I guess so. So we turned. Instead of everybody going in a line turning, we turned. And as we did, out of the smoke came Capel towards us. Well, we went hard a port and full astern. But before that happened, we managed to just tip the stern of Capel. And she could have missed us by altering course to starboard, but they didn't. I don't know why the hell they didn't to this day. Thank God they'd set their depth charges to safe. Otherwise it would have blown the stern off her and probably blown us up too. Anyway, the foot of our bow was turned in, okay, like so.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, everybody went home and we gradually got back to Plymouth. We went into the dry dock, got that fixed up. And then before that, there was another occasion when we were standing off the French coast and going like the clappers, heading into the sunset, heading west, almost due west. And a Heinkel came in over our starboard quarter, and he let go one of these 1,000-pound glider bombs, which are highly exciting.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, here we are, and we can see this damn thing. And we can't reach him. Our guns couldn't get anywhere near him. We haven't got the ability to fire up that high anyway, because 45 degrees is all we could get. And he's sitting out here, and obviously thinking, hell, he's got a good thing going here. And the bomb zigged, we zagged, and this sort of stuff. And eventually, it landed down between us and the next over, but very close to us. When I say very close, it was enough to heel the ship over, stop her. We were doing 25 knots. Stopped it. We lost vacuum, and we're just drifting for a very short while.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we got bits and pieces of that casing off that bomb on the upper deck. We had enough to give a little bit of the aluminum that encased this thing. To almost all the guys in the ship's company.
For a souvenir.
Yeah, so yeah. It wasn't very many seconds after that the old fires caught again. And we got steam. The next thing, the senior officer said, Skeena, wait for us, please. As we smoke belching from our funnels, we steamed ahead of the whole lot. We were all in line abreast, you know, 1, 2, 3, like so.
Yeah.
Going this way. So anyway, back after we got out of the dry dock, my captain said to me, look, if you're interested in that girl, you know, you better go and do something. So that was when I rushed up to Belfast and I proposed to my wife, and that was on a Wednesday, and then we were married, no, on a Friday, we were married the following Wednesday.
Oh, wow.
In Plymouth, actually Devonport. And 5 days later, she went back to work in the cellars of the Belfast Castle, that's the dungeon, where they converted it to a communication center, and I went back to sea. Well, We did a couple of patrols. As we were now reformed as EG-11, and with Capel in command, with a guy by the name of Prentice, Captain Prentice, Commander Prentice. And we eventually were patrolling south of Iceland when the dreadful October hurricane developed, a deep depression, with winds up to 100 miles an hour, and we were invited to come in by the shore authority. Prior to that time, the captain and I were hanging on in the chart house, and I said to him, "Jesus, you know, I'm bloody glad we're out here, because we could take anything out here, because this ship can do it. But we mustn't go in that bloody anchorage, because it's volcanic ash bottom. It's like sugar. And we dragged twice before." And right. I said, "With our centerline capstan, we could only work one anchor at a time. And so I just think it's great to be out here." Well, when that message came in, the old man said, "Okay, we'll go in." So I said to him, "I'm sorry, but I have to ask to be relieved of my duties. I'm not about to do that. I can't." So he said, "Well, I respect your views, pilot," he said, "but will you take her and put her in the place where you think she would be safest?" So I said, "Sure," which I did. 800 yards from the beach in any direction, thinking that the storm would pass through and hence the wind direction would change mm-hmm. with the storm going through. And I taught meteorology amongst other things, so I had a bit of a clue. But the trouble was we put the pick down. I think we had 5.5 shackles, if I can recall, in something like 12 fathoms of water. So it was
fairly shallow.
It was pretty shallow, but 5.5 shackles should have been enough. According to the Admiralty Manual, it was plenty.
Mm-hmm.
But there was only one light that we could take a bearing on. And we had these snow squalls, and they lasted for about 8 minutes, 6 to 8 minutes. And the anchor held, the ship was well held for about an hour. And I went aft and lay on my bunk, and the next thing I knew was this god-awful feeling, and I knew it was game over, because the ship was doing this bang, we just on the rocks. And she broached to. She. What happened was that she was yawing up to the wind. Like the wind is coming this way, the ship is on her cable.
Mm-hmm.
And we even put a port anchor, let it drop underfoot, but that wasn't enough. And she was swinging up like so. And as she got up, the wind was so strong, it just took the ship like this. And so when we hit the beach, we were broadside onto it, and we didn't realize it, of course. And she lay into the sea, so each wave that hit her, right over the top, she went up, down, bang, and then of course she cracked. We had oil and slush. It was 31 degrees air, Fahrenheit,
mm-hmm.
and 42 in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cold, bloody cold, and it was windy, of course.
The wind makes it really cold.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus. But oh God, I don't know. Anyway. We had a number of the guys went into Carly floats, and then got the Carly floats over the side. The ship's boats were, we attempted to lower them, and they were just crushed alongside by the mill race that formed between the ship and the shore, and on the seaside as well. Anyway, it's a long, dreary tale, but it was, we lost 15 guys that night. And in the morning, the wind had dropped, and we were able to, with a breeches boy, to all of us get ashore. And that's when I was the canteen officer, so I went down below with the chief yeoman, Wild Bill Kelly, and we emptied the canteen locker and the safe of all the money, lugged it ashore, and which was heavy, to say the least. Paper wasn't, but the coins were. Brit coins were big in those days. And eventually we ended up in a place called NAFI, Navy Army Air Force Institute Stores in Londonderry. And when I went in, and I said who I was, they said, "Oh yes, we know all about you. You're from Skeena." And I said, "Well, we've come to pay our bill." And they said, "Oh no, no, no. You don't owe us anything. It's all insured." And so we said, "Oh really? Thank you very much." So we took this wad of money, which came to, I don't know, about £2,300, and it was subsequently divided amongst the families of the people who were lost.
Right.
And so that was the end of Skeena, and that was pretty well the end of my war, with the exception that I after the trials that took place in Halifax, courts martial for the captain and the first lieutenant, I was a witness, which was a bitter pill to start with. I came back in a ship called Seacliff, which was on her first operational cruise, commanded by a wonderful guy from Quebec City, Eric Harrington, J.E. Harrington. As I say, it was his first operational cruise. The ship had just been worked up. She'd only been built that year, and I was a passenger, and the only one who had any schooling in German at my Lisgar Collegiate in Ottawa, where 3 years worth of it, but I still was not conversant at all. Anyway, between ourselves and our sister ship in that convoy, or one of them, we got a submarine, and as a result we got half the crew from this submarine, which turned out it was on its first operational cruise as well, and they were all very young. The first lieutenant was only 21, just a mere kid
my age.
Yeah, well, he,
I'm not quite 21, but still
Austrian, nice guy, not like you. He was fair haired blonde, typical Nordic, Teutonic, I should say, more. Very pleasant. And I started to try to speak to him in German. And he looked at me as if to say, "Oh, yeah." And said, "Excuse me, sir. Do you mind? It's probably better if we speak in English. I went to school in England." So that was the end of that.
Yeah.
Me trying to speak German through with an English-German naval equivalence handbook. Not good. Anyway. When we eventually got ashore, all those people, they were lined up by their own officers, and they gave us three cheers for saving them. And the point really was that by this time in 1944, even first cruise operational ships were much better outfitted than the Germans, and who again by this time, one operational cruise was usually the norm, and they were sunk. And by the end of the war, we sank something like 750 U-boats, and with the loss of between 30,000 and 40,000 of the German naval personnel.
I think it's 30,000.
Terrible.
It's
anyway,
lots.
Oh yeah, and it had everything to do with this gradual preponderance of equipments and the gradual development of drills, training procedures, and combined skills and unit ability. If you combine that with what we call hunter-killer groups, which are small, what we call Woolworth carriers, there were merchant ships on which the top was carved and they put a flight deck on them, and they operated Hellcats and other sort of Grumman type torpedo bombers, along with escorts, and they scoured the oceans quite separately from the convoys and their groups, and they had a field day, because it was the aircraft who could spot these guys before they could get away, and a lot of them sank that way. Mm-hmm. There's a very interesting story about a boat called the I-51. She was Japanese. She came all the way from Tokyo to Singapore, where they loaded up with all kinds of good stuff, including gold and manganese and molybdenum and
fancy metals.
The idea, and they brought her all the way around, and they were being tracked by this time, and they got into the Atlantic, and they got well up into mid-Atlantic, and they were popped by a U.S. Escort group, not escort group, but counter killer group.
Mm-hmm.
And they were big boats, really big, much bigger than anything else that was afloat or under the seas in those days. So once again, it was that total combined thing that eventually won the day.
Right. All right, just to finish up then, is there anything of note, I mean, in your long haul there, in terms of your service in the Atlantic and in the Channel, just that might be of note or of some value about ASW and just your time in general, anything of note?
Well, perhaps one of the things that came out of it all was that we fought the ship from the bridge. The captain was on the bridge, the navigator was on the bridge, the gunnery officer was on the bridge, the communicator was on the bridge. And this goes back to times of Nelson and before. And the plotting capability that as we went forward in the war improved. And so that whereas in the beginning, and indeed through to what we had when I was operating off the French coast, was really dead wrong. The plotting officer was the supply officer usually, or maybe somebody else was detailed off for it. And you had the radar reporters down there. But there was no what I call action officer who was could take control. The information was passed to the bridge, and the bridge in its wisdom, in the darkness, and with guns going off and goodness knows what else going on, they really weren't anything like as adequately equipped as they should be. Well, there was a thing called Action Information Organization, and this gradually grew from those endeavors at near the end of the war, where instead of fighting the ship from the bridge, the whole business of command and control went down close to the equipments, as is the modern situation today. The captain doesn't fight the ship from the bridge. That's crazy. And indeed, when I went out to Korea in Cayuga, I never went on the bridge when we were having our night actions and opposition firings. No, I was down with the plot. The captain was on the bridge enjoying the stars. But the gunnery officer and I were the ones who fought the ship. And so this is how this thing evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And it was long overdue when it arrived, that's for sure. But as far as I was concerned, I had relatively speaking, I suppose, a very exciting war. I was in my youth and in my so-called prime, having a hell of a good time. We had great people to work with. We made lifelong lasting friends. At times, as I said earlier, it was miserable, cold, wet, scary. I nearly fell over the side once because of a wave. But I hung on to one of those lifelines, which eventually got me a disability pension because I was thrown against the dip charge drawer and caused a certain amount of anguish. But that's another story altogether. And my time spent in the RN, I enjoyed it immensely. We had a great time. I was one of two Canadians in the cruiser in which I served, and again I was the only Canadian in the Hunt class destroyer, and in the battleship it didn't really matter. We were all a gaggle of people from all over the fleet being given a crammer's course to try to get us ready for our exams. And but again, the people with whom I came in contact were all highly supportive, and I think I learned a little bit. I hope so. I was meant to. And subsequently, I was allowed to take the specialist course in navigation and aircraft control, and subsequently my flying license for Tiger Moss. No, it was an A license. It's great fun. Highly exciting.
Anyway.
All of that was good. And again, I went back to the UK in 1956 to do what they call a senior officer staff course. And that was good. I was given a command on return and had another command immediately following the first one. And I was navigator of Ontario, our cruiser, around South America, over to the UK and back. All of those appointments were great. And I had a very happy family life, and they were my four children all grew up. They're still around, I'm glad to say.
Good.
And my wife died, unfortunately, in 99, but we had a good time all through our service lives, and at one point I was sent eventually to be the executive officer of our largest shore base, which was Shearwater, and I was meant to be there for only a year, then promoted to captain and go on, and for some reasons which are personal, I wasn't. And then eventually, after I did my time in joint staff and went on to be the deputy secretary of the defense staff for administration under this new unification business, I was sent for one day, and after they said, the DM said, you're doing very well with the English publications. Where are the French ones? So I said, sir, as the language of NATO is English, we thought we'd better get on with that one first, as it's the operational language. He said, no, start the French ones tomorrow. I said, okay. So I had a staff of 143 people working on all this, every damn conceivable kind of thing you can think of, to bring all the three services in the Defense Research Board rules under this, an amalgam, to get the so-called best of that, out of everything, whether it be dentists or artists or you name it. Aviators and seamen and submariners and pongos of every stripe. So then I was sent for about 5 weeks later, and they said, where do you want to go? I said, what do you mean, where do I want to go? Am I not being confirmed by force track? Nope. Moreover, you're not being promoted. So where do you want to go? Well, I'm 45 years old. I got 5 years left of uncompleted time, which meant this, that by the time I'd been promoted to commander, in 38, I guess it was. No, not 38. 57. I promoted commander. This is now 64. And I'm still a commander. And I said, well, I've got 5 years of uncompleted time, which means this, that people who are in the rank of commander, if they're not promoted to captain at 50, they have to go out. So, but between the age of 45 and 50, I had to serve. And if I resigned earlier, I lost 5% of my pension for every year of uncompleted time, or I would have lost 25% of my pension,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't very big anyway. As it was when I went out, I had a pension of $8,000 a year. So,
not too much.
Not those days. Anyway, so I said, okay, I must go to a place that pays captain's pay for the last 4 years or last 5 years. Eventually, that's why I went to Virginia. So they paid acting captain's pay down there. And allowances. And then in the last few years of my service, the rates went up, and that all helped. But still, I still went up with $8,400 a year. And went to Osgoode Hall, where I started at $10,000 a year. And by the time I left, it was up to 25. Came back out here, started at 12. And 5 years later, I was back. Where I left at 12 years later, was back to where I was when I left Osgoode. So,
yeah.
But money wasn't the answer. That wasn't the name of the game. But on the other hand, when I was given this ultimatum, I had one child in kindergarten, another one heading for university, and two in between. One about to become a nurse, she thought, and she did, at the Ottawa Civic Hospital. And the other one was about to go into high school, which he did when he went to Virginia. So I had this spread of my troops. So,
good.
Anyway. So that's about it. And the only thing that today I've been one of the outspoken people about the dire state of our forces been allowed to be cut and cut and cut by Trudeau in particular, and onward from them. And at last, there's a glimmer of hope, but it's only a glimmer at the moment. And I just pray to God that somebody has enough guts to make it so, because our country is irrelevant on the world stage today. We are. We're irrelevant. Who the hell pays attention to Canada anymore? Forget it. Our voice is a voice in the wilderness. It used to be quite the contrary. At the end of the war, we had the third largest navy in the West. And our Air Force and Army were the best. Our forces everywhere were recognized as being not huge in number, but the best in training, efficiency, and equipment. Everything. I was allowed to go to ratchet.
Well, I guess we can end on that somewhat sour note. But
well, no. As I say, there's hope. But it's hope only. You see, our shipyards have been allowed to wither. When you talk about building new ferries, they go where the money is. They'll be good. They'll be fine.
All right.
A lot of other things are not good. We're off the air.